Hello. Once again, welcome to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm your co-host, Jack Sneflin.
This is episode 14 of our Disney bracket. This week, we will be discussing Zootopia from 2016 versus The Little Mermaid from 1989.
So I think the topic at hand is world building. So that's what a lot of this is going to be. We'll try to get into other things too, but that's a big part of both these movies.
I do also want to mention, we're going to be talking about some of the sexualization that goes on in The Little Mermaid, and we're definitely going to be talking about racial politics in Zootopia. If you don't want to engage with either of those things, you might want to bow out now.
Also, we are two white male assigned at birth people, so there are probably some things we're not going to get right. We apologize for that.
We're going to do our best.
Valor Morghulis. Before we start, actually, I have a game show for this. So, in Zootopia, we see Judy Hopps, who lives in a world populated by anthropomorphic animals, scrolling through her iPod, and there are a variety of popular music artists with animal pun names. I'm going to read you three, and you're going to tell me which one of these was not from Zootopia.
Okay.
Guns N' Roses, Katy Perry, and Skink Floyd.
I'm going to say Skink Floyd was not there.
Ah, yeah, nice.
That was just a total guess, like, more based on what would Judy Hopps listen to on her iPad?
That's fair.
Also, the other big tell is there are only mammals in Zootopia. There are no reptiles.
Oh, cock and balls. You're right. I shot myself in the paw. Anyway, let's get to summaries. In Zootopia, Judy Hopps lives in a world of anthropomorphic animals that has moved beyond predator and prey. She dreams of being the first rabbit police officer. She pushes herself beyond her limits and graduates top of her class at Harvard for police and is sent to work for Zootopia Police Department, only to be assigned traffic duty while everyone else is assigned the big case, the 14 missing persons, all predators. While on the job, she fails to outwit Fox con artist Nick Wilde. Then, she causes a fracas trying to catch a thief who turns out was just after some bulbs and is nearly fired. But a chance run-in with a very sad otter who's missing her husband and the deputy mayor Bellwether, a sheep, puts her cap in a position where he has to assign her to the case of the missing otter. But she only has 3 days or it's her badge. She realizes Nick might have been a witness and cons him into helping her. They develop a camaraderie as they track down the last person who saw the otter alive, a panther, who tells him the otter said something about night howlers before going berserk. Then, the panther goes berserk too. He vanishes, but traffic cams show a bunch of wolves, the night howlers, taking him away to a spooky facility. All the predators are in a gulag, while the doctors and the lion mayor are trying to cure them in secret before the public finds out, to avoid panic. Judy exposes them and is regaled as a hero. Unfortunately, at a press conference, she repeats something she heard a doctor say, that the berserking might be in the predator's DNA. The city turns against predators. Now mayor, Bellwether asks Judy to be the public liaison with ZPD, but aghast at what's happened, she instead turns in her badge and goes home to accept her fate as a carrot farmer. In a run-in with a childhood bully, now her parents' business partner, she learns that there is a bulb, called a night howler, that turns rabbits berserk. She realizes that it can affect anybody, and runs back to Zootopia to crack the case, and make up with Nick. They find the facility making night howler bullets, and in the process of getting the evidence back to ZPD, Mayor Bellwether accosts them. Discovering she was behind the whole thing, they trick her into revealing on tape that it was a prey supremacist conspiracy, and she's arrested. The predators are all cured, and Nick becomes Judy's partner, ZPD's first fox.
Meanwhile, in The Little Mermaid, during what should have been her musical debut, Ariel, Princess of Atlantica, is instead out collecting human artifacts from shipwrecks with her fish friend Flounder. Her father, King Triton, and her music instructor, Sebastian, are furious with her, and Triton forbids her from interacting with the surface world, and assigns Sebastian to watch her. Sebastian is terrible at his new assignment, and he fails to prevent Ariel from going to the surface to spy on a human ship. The ship in question belongs to Prince Eric, and he and his crew are celebrating his birthday. Ariel watches Eric dance and party and is immediately infatuated. Unfortunately, the party is cut short by a storm that sets the ship ablaze. Most of the crew escape, but Eric is tossed overboard. Ariel saves the unconscious prince from drowning and sings to him on the beach, but leaves just as he wakes up fully. Triton is enraged when he learns of Ariel's love for a human and destroys her collection of human salvage. Ursula the Sea Witch then capitalizes on the familial strife and offers to give Ariel legs for 3 days so that she may woo the prince. But if she fails, she will become Ursula's prisoner. The only cost for the opportunity? Ariel's voice. The mermaid agrees. Ariel runs into trouble wooing the prince as a mute, as Eric is obsessed with finding the singing girl who saved him from drowning. Sebastian attempts to serenade the couple, but Ursula's lackeys ruin the moment. After the close call, Ursula disguises herself as a human and uses Ariel's voice to hypnotize Eric into marriage. Ariel and friends are able to stop the wedding, but Ariel's time has run out and she transforms back. Ursula taunts Triton with the contract and convinces him to trade places with Ariel. Ursula then takes control of the Triton and enlarges herself. Eric then impales Ursula on the bowsprit of his ship, defeating her. All of Ursula's prisoners are released from their polyp forms, and Triton sees the error of his ways, transforming Ariel into a human and allowing her to marry Eric.
Nice use of the word bowsprit. Also, I want to be the kind of person who has the Sea Witch as a title. Like, when you're like, oh yes, Jackson, the Sea Witch. We'll get to my Ursula fangirling later. We'll start with Zootopia.
As a police drama narrative, this movie works incredibly well.
There's gangs, there's twists. On its own, it's very solid, and it's a pretty new genre for Disney. I don't think they've ever really done that kind of thing with animation.
Not really. This is also very much just a buddy cop film.
Yeah.
And our two protagonists, Judy and Nick, separately are great, and they play off each other incredibly well.
Judy is really good at finding loopholes in the law that allow her to manipulate Nick while also using Nick's willingness to break the law to facilitate her being in positions where she can solve the case without going above and beyond too far. Like, there's a really great bit where she has something he wants, so she throws it over a wall and he has to go for it. But because he's breaking and entering, she can now cross the wall because there's probable cause, and that allows her to investigate the place he was breaking into.
Mm-hmm. They do a really good job of characterizing just how much of a lawful good character that Judy is. During her first day, she's assigned traffic duty and has to hand out traffic tickets. There's one point where the little golf cart that she's driving is parked and the meter expires, and she writes herself a ticket. And I think that's just some really great character building without any sort of verbal interactions. It's just, here's the situation, here's what happens, and it tells you a lot about Judy as a person.
And they made the sensible choice of casting Jennifer Goodwin, who is a literal bunny in human form, to play a rabbit, so I was proud of them for that.
It's also really interesting seeing a female cop as the lead character in this film. That is definitely playing against stereotype that you would typically have for a film like this, and I give Disney quite a bit of props.
It also has some gorgeous animation. We get these wonderful sweeping vistas of Zootopia with all these different biomes, and they all have this beautiful, colorful bloom to them. Also, the animal models are very good. There are a few scenes where characters go from being sapient, as it were, to feral, and the models don't seem to change that much. It's just a matter of changing how the animals are posed. It means they had good modeling there.
The models were close enough to reality to where they didn't look weird on all fours, but standing upright and doing things, they didn't look out of place. I think most of the changes visually that happen after they are exposed to the night howler is really in the eyes and how the iris color tends to change, or the pupils become very enlarged, and the much more erratic movement as opposed to very deliberate movement that you would have as a sapient, intelligent character.
You also have some fun visual world building with the sort of things you would expect to have in a society where the citizens are of vastly different sizes.
You've got these rodent tunnels for like shrews and lemmings and whatnot to crawl around in, but then next to them you have these huge open doors for elephants to walk through.
Nick's whole con that Judy fails to stop is him buying a frozen treat designed for elephants and then using that one thing that he paid not much for to make a bunch of frozen treats for smaller sized creatures and making a mint off of that, which is a clever con that would only really happen in this society.
There's also the fact that technically nothing he did was illegal. The worst thing he did was tug on Judy's heartstrings to get her to pay for the jumbo pop. And there's also her paying for that is in and of itself more about Judy's internalized racist upbringing and her sort of paying it forward to absolve herself of her sins.
I like the bit where he pulls out all of his certificates for, you know, like selling wood and food merchandising, that kind of thing, where it's like, oh, this is all technically above board.
We talked about the voice cast a little bit already, but casting J.K. Simmons as Mayor Lionheart was great. He does an excellent job of just being this pretentious, egotistical ass.
Mm-hmm.
I love it.
They also do a good job of finding a blend between still looking like the animals they're portraying and having recognizable human emotions.
I also want to talk about Clawhauser and how great of a character he is. Clawhauser is the deputy who works the front desk of Central District.
Yeah.
He's the queer-coded leopard.
Yeah, I had some complaints about him in some ways, but say the good things and I'll say my bad things.
I think it works really well that he's queer-coded, especially later on the film, where they move him down to records as they don't want to have him be the face of the city center district and have him working the front desk. And I think having that character be removed from a position that he loves works on lots of different levels for the film.
I was at times a little unsure how well they're handling him being a fat character.
That's completely valid.
Yeah, he was a relatively delightful character in his queer coding. Kapui's donuts thing was a little messy, but it doesn't get gone into too much, so it doesn't really come up.
Yeah, it's complicated. For the most part, I didn't have a problem with it. I think if they removed the joke where he has a donut stuck under his chin, then everything would have been fine.
Yeah,
I don't think you needed that there at all. It's really mean to Clawhauser.
Mm-hmm. There is a great bit where he has like some phone app where it puts your face on the face of a dancer next to Gazelle, who's kind of the Shakira of this world. And then later he walks into the office where Idris Elba, Captain, is using the same app and trying to hide the fact that he's doing so. And that was a good little gag. Let's get into the DVDs thing. I think that'll be fun.
The meta humor. There's a couple aspects of Disney using meta humor here. There's one point where Chief Bogo says something.
Life isn't some cartoon musical where you sing a little song and your insipid dreams magically come true.
Disney loves diving into self-deprecating humor recently. They also, when they meet up with the Weasel character again, Duke Weaselton.
Sure.
And he's selling bootleg DVDs of a bunch of animal pun-based Disney films.
Like Wreck-It Rhino and Meowna.
Including some that are not released yet, like
functionally Frozen and 2 and Gigantic.
Which Gigantic is no longer on Disney's release schedule.
It was in development hell for a while. It was basically Jack and the Beanstalk, but the first giant that Jack meets is a child. I see what they're doing with it. It looks like it was going to be kind of a cool concept, but apparently they just can't make it work. And they shelved it. So that particular bit has not aged well.
We'll have to see. Disney tends to not throw things away when they shelve them.
And Disney's management has changed up a lot recently, so who knows what's going to happen now.
It's interesting to look at the meta humor here and some of the stuff that's happened in Moana and other recent Disney films. And I think one of the reasons that it's pervading so much is the demographic shift of who Disney is aiming at. Now, most young children, their parents are millennials. Specifically millennials who have also been watching Disney films for most of their formative years, since Disney didn't really get into the home video business until the early 90s, late 80s. So they are both playing mostly to their adult audience to bring their kids along, but also playing on this history that they've had with this audience for 20 or 30 years at this point. And I think that's mostly the reason why we're seeing that shift of meta humor, is Disney can reliably assume that the people coming to see their movies have been coming to see their movies since they were children.
Although, like we talked about a bit in Moana, the meta humor doesn't always work. It can sometimes be a bit mean-spirited, and it can be kind of weird for Disney to be trashing their own brand. Speaking of things that kids will remember, let's talk about the Godfather. Part of the investigation leads them to a mafia boss who's Mr. Big. He's a shrew. He has a bunch of polar bear thugs, whatever. And he comes out and he's just like,
"You come here unannounced on the day my daughter is to be married. No. I trusted you, Nikki. I welcomed you into my home. We broke bread together. Grandmama made you a cannoli."
I don't know how many kids are gonna like recognize The Godfather.
I think there's enough of The Godfather that is just sort of cultural osmosis that young children probably won't get it, but the 10, 12 year olds that are watching this probably have some familiarity with some of those tropes. And especially since it is a crime drama at the core of this film, it entirely makes sense for Disney to play off of one of the best crime thrillers of all time.
Mm-hmm.
There is some weird stuff going on, though. So, Nick has history with Mr. Big. Specifically, he sold him a fur rug made out of a skunk's butt. Skunks aren't, like, shorn for their hair, which leads me to question, is that the analog of this world to, I just sold you human leather?
Is this sort of getting to how weird the world building is in this?
Yeah, like, that was pretty much my only problem with the world building. Everything else, they did a really good job of having it make sense for the most part.
Oh, okay. So what we're presented with isn't unbelievable, but there's a lot that doesn't make sense to me. Like, why has there never been a rabbit police officer before? Also, this place appears to be a primarily, like, rabbit-based society. How do they police themselves? Why doesn't she become a police officer in whatever system they use? Do they have, like, a sort of neighborhood watch type thing? It seems like there's a noticeable size difference for many groups. Why aren't the police officers sized based on the communities they can best serve? Like a mouse division for the like the small folks, and then a wildebeest division for the big folks.
Well, why don't majority Black or Latino communities have predominantly Black or Latino police officers policing them?
That's a really good question.
Yeah, I can't blame the movie too much for something that the real world hasn't figured out yet.
I can, because this is a utopia. it's literally a utopia. A zoo in our world is a prison for animals, so you have the literalization of Angela Davis's theory put forward in Freedom is a Constant Struggle, where she talks about how in Zionist-occupied Palestine, you move merely from a subtle prison to an overt prison when you're sent to jail in Palestine. That's not, maybe not what they were going for, but that's what I got from it. Also, fox repellent is a thing that you can just buy and it's apparently legal to have. I'm uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, it's definitely weird to me. So we're already kind of there anyway, so let's just go ahead and dive into how this movie deals with prejudice. There are two levels of prejudice in this film. There's the prey-predator dynamic and the prejudice there. But also, there's individual species prejudices that are going on that, with the exception of foxes being untrustworthy and bunnies being small and can't be police officers, the film is more than happy to play into those stereotypes most of the time. Mm-hmm. Like with the lemmings.
The DMV is run by sloths who are all really slow.
So there are some problems with kind of singling out, well, the prejudice that our two main characters face is bad, but the stereotypes of these other animals are totally true. There are some issues there. Most of those sorts of stereotypes are actually really funny, though, and it's difficult to figure out what the movie wants you to feel about that, because that's where most of their humor is coming from. And if this were any other talking animal narrative, there wouldn't be an issue.
But unfortunately, this movie wants to talk about prejudice in a big way. This movie reads very much as a narrative about racial injustice, and the creators have definitely come out as saying that that was the plan, but no matter how you unpack it, it does not work.
Watching through this film, most of the evidence points to one of two ways to unpack the prejudice and animosity between the prey and predators. Before I get into those two things, I do want to point out that almost the entire development team is white, and it probably would have behooved them to have some more people of color involved in constructing this narrative, because their unfamiliarity shows. Like, they know about things that happen in our world that are examples of prejudice, and they kind of sprinkle them throughout the film and whatnot. But they don't do it in a very considered way. And so everything ends up really muddy. And now we'll get into the two ways to read this film. So there's one way, which is the more obvious way to read it, as predators are supposed to be a stand-in for minority classes. So people of color, the LGBTQ community, the disabled, what have you. And there's plenty to back that up. We have the very rural farming family that Judy grows up in, and they have a very strong fear of predators.
Which plays off of the idea of the rural working class being primarily white and prejudiced against people of color, which is a common assumption that often erases the diversity in rural areas?
Again, you can see the analogs to predators equals people of color with the interactions that Judy has with Nick in and just outside of the ice cream shop, where she kind of goes in and unholsters her fox spray before she really has any sort of idea of what's going on in the situation. Then seeing that, oh, this man is just trying to buy ice cream for his son, immediately feels awful about herself, and then ends up buying the jumbo pop for Nick and his quote-unquote son to kind of make up for it. And then in the conversation outside,
you know, it burns me up to see folks with such backward attitudes toward foxes.
And she calls Nick an articulate fella.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that.
And Nick, not missing a beat, remains calm, but is a subtle dig. It's like,
it's rare that I find someone so non-patronizing.
So in my description, I use the word berserk or feral, but the word they use here is a word that indigenous people have repeatedly asked people to stop using, and that we kind of brought up a bit in our Pocahontas review. So you have this idea of these dangerous people who are being allowed into our society, but now that they're always at risk of reverting to their bestial nature. So there's that.
And there's many other examples of the read of predators as minority communities. The other way to read this film is that the predators are an analog to what would be the white ruling class, and that their power is finally on a decline. And that's where this animosity is coming from. You can get little glimpses of this with the scene at the beginning where Judy confronts Gideon, and some of the rhetoric that Gideon is spouting about predators definitely has a white supremacist lean to it. There's also the fact that at one point Judy first meets Clawhauser. Clawhauser calls her cute. And she's like,
a bunny can call another bunny cute, but when other animals do it, it's a little...
I am so sorry.
As an analog to the N-word. There's also this other scene. Nick is playing with the wool on top of Assistant Mayor Bedweather's head.
Yeah.
And Judy, it's kind gross. Of...
You can't just touch a sheep's wool.
It's like cotton candy.
Stop it.
And that kind of is analogous to the issues that black women have with people touching their hair without asking. The film kind of goes back and forth on this, providing evidence for one way or the other, and it's never clear what the film actually wants.
And because of that, if you try to scratch below the surface, it kind of breaks down with the source of that prejudice and how it's systemic.
And specifically, who is the privileged party between these two groups? They could have much more easily shifted most of the things towards a sort of sexist viewpoint, as a racist viewpoint, with how unappreciated Mayor Bellwether is and all the difficulties that Judy has joining the police academy and people underestimating her. I definitely think that there's enough content there where you could have shifted the narrative if you made it a few other changes throughout the film. And I think if they went that direction, the prejudice narrative would have been much stronger and you wouldn't have had nearly as much of a muddy main point of this film. I remember first coming out of this film, like, feeling pretty good. It's like, that was a really great anti-prejudice narrative. And I think that's where most kids are going to come out of this at. But as soon as you start looking at it closely and analyzing things from a more nuanced adult perspective, things are going to break down incredibly quickly.
Speaking of things with weird world building, let's get into Little Mermaid.
Yeah, I think we've about covered as much as I'm willing to do here for Zootopia.
Yeah. I'm going to admit, going in, I'm a huge apologist for this movie for a particular reason. A big part of millennial film criticism, and I think a big part of this influences the meta humor of Disney recently, is finding ways to poke holes in the Disney princess films. And Ariel is kind of one of the most obvious ones because her story is reduced to she sold her soul for a vag, is a reduction of the conflicts at hand that devalue why this film was able to be resonant with people. And because of that, I defend Ariel and Little Mermaid as a whole possibly more than I really should. but also has Ursula.
Of course you're an Ursula stan. She's queer, fat, and does crime.
Chelsea Rebecca at one point made a point that Ursula could at any point choose to be a skinny hot lady, but she doesn't. And I think that's a really astute look at the film, that Ursula has the ability to be traditionally good looking, but she instead, for whatever reason, feels most comfortable as this fat squid monster. And I'm like, yes, good. I want that kind of bodily confidence.
There are ways in which the film does not do the best job with Ursula. There's, I think it might be when we're first introduced to her, where she complains about her being banished from Lantica, and so she's stuck there.
Wasted away to practically nothing.
And then she comes out of the shadows, and you see her full-bodied form. And I get that it's supposed to be sort of tongue-in-cheek, but it's probably not the best fat rep that you could do.
But the rest is not half bad. I mean, there's the, like, her being really the only fat character in the narrative beyond, I guess, the chef. And her having this monstrous body, both with the tentacles and her fatness being, like, arguably monstrous if you want to read it that way. There's definitely ways in which it's not great, but on the flip side, if you're the kind of person who feels like an outcast or an exile, I can see why this character would resonate.
Also, I'd just like to point out that this is the second film in as many years where Disney had a loan shark as the main antagonist.
Oh, yeah.
Oliver and Company in 88.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow. This film definitely, you can tell that it was the start of the Disney Renaissance.
Yeah. Artistically, it's definitely on the weaker side, but it's distinctly a step up from Oliver and Company. It definitely works as a stepping stone into the more artistically ambitious films that came later on in the 90s.
Some of the background characters. I feel like characters from Cinderella as opposed to characters from Beauty and the Beast. Although on the flip side, you have some really interesting animation things where you have either really beautiful colors being used and good lighting effects from when Triton's staff is going off, when lightning's flashing, or you'll have these very muted colors and it feels like you're in a cloudy skied sea.
On the other hand, you then have the abomination that is Flounder's face in a front-on view.
Oh yeah, remember how in Zootopia we talked about how they do a good job melding human and animal faces?
They do not do that here.
No, they do not. And a lot of other characters stylized, like Sebastian is...
It looks like they took a sea slug and just replaced the crab head with that. And Sebastian doesn't make any sort of sense at all from a biological perspective.
And there's a shark that has very weird proportions that make him seem more like a big muscly dude who is also a shark. A lot of the models are more caricatures than realistic, and I'm okay with that. Doesn't bother me too much, but some of them are spooky to look at, like Flounder.
Uncanny Valley territory.
Somebody, some poor interns had to do all the seafoam and bubbles in all these shots of these, like, hand-animated things and beatify them. Like, they, dear gods.
There's at one point in the film where Ariel finds out that there's going to be a wedding, and she's under the false assumption that it's going to be hers, where she runs down the stairs.
Oh, those stairs.
And the stairs are computer generated and they look atrocious.
It's really bad because, like, the next shot is this gorgeous traditionally painted thing with dawn light coming into the room and it's lovely and golden.
And you see that, like, the tile work that's on the floor and you've got these decorative pillars and it looks great. And I don't know why they had to cut corners the way they did with the stairs.
There are some good shots though. You have some really fun perspective shots where you're seeing all the components of Ariel's grotto and you're looking around at all the dingle hoppers and gizmos and that kind of thing. Because they're underwater and characters are moving around in three dimensions, you can have the camera far back and see all the seafloor below with sunken ships or Ursula's sea monster bone cave or Triton's palace that is open air, as it were.
They do a good job of utilizing the three-dimensional space during the underwater scenes, mm-hmm. as opposed to just, no, we're going to treat them as if they're walking on land that is just water.
A lot of good shots where the character's hair is flowing about as if it were underwater, which looks really cool.
On the flip side, though, they do a terrible job of doing Ariel's hair when she comes out of the water. It should be just plastered against her face.
Beauty is never tarnished, even by water. Speaking of beauty, let's talk about Ariel as a character.
She's a really well-written teenager. That would be a compliment if I didn't hate how well-written of a teenager she is.
She does make a number of bad choices, although I think a lot of them are pretty motivated, like her decision to make the deal with Ursula despite knowing that she's Ursula the Sea Witch. It comes right on the heels of her father committing an act of domestic violence that basically tells her, no, this thing you love, you're not allowed to, and I will use my incredible magical powers to enforce that.
Yeah, the deal with Ursula makes sense, and the infatuation with Eric makes sense.
It's basically that thing where the worst of otakus are, like, super into Japanese ladies because they're Japanese. It's not presented as creepy in the way that that is, but it's that kind of thing.
It does feel a little bit creepy on the ship scene with how stalkery Ariel kind of feels while she's watching Eric.
The line between Ariel is fascinated by all of this and Ariel is obsessed with all of this is very thin, and I think the film doesn't quite do a good enough job of showing the dangers of obsession. It comes close. It comes really close. I think you kind of have to analyze it to get that.
There's also just the problem of the 16-year-old making the decision to go after Eric, and, you know, there's the deal with Sea Witch, and then they defeat her, and the wedding continues in spite of the fact that she is a very naive teenager who's gone through lots of trauma in the past week.
Mm-hmm. We don't know exactly when that wedding happens. There's an offline by Grimsby in a few scenes earlier where, like,
these things do take time.
So you could argue that that happened months or even years later, but it's not clear at all. And that's more me being an apologist than me being like, there's proof from the text.
If it was, we're going to be engaged, and then the Little Mermaid TV series actually included Eric and all the issues with traversing the Kingdom of Atlantica with Eric's kingdom and all that sort of stuff, that I think would have gotten rid of all my problems. But as far as I can tell, that is not a thing.
Mm-hmm. There's this other weird thing where Ariel is doing a lot of things with Eric in the kingdom and exploring the human world, and then she finds out that Eric is engaged to Vanessa, which is Ursula's human Sona, and she just sort of doesn't do anything for the rest of the day while this is all going forward, and that makes perfect sense. I retract that complaint. That is exactly what I did when I was 16 and I found out that Joel from the robotics club was straight. Never mind. I was useless for a week. Ariel did very well in that she was only useless for about 8 hours. I do appreciate that she saves Eric from drowning.
Yes, we do have that, but there's also the fact that our main character's voice is taken away from her for a vast majority of the film, which means it's very difficult to understand what's going on with her thoughts and feelings and stuff like that. And to a certain extent, she loses quite a bit of agency after that happens. So while, yes, she does have the proactive moment of saving Eric, it's then immediately contrasted with a length of time where she literally has no voice.
This also gets into one of my complaints about the structure of the film. We don't really need Under the Sea for the plot. And then we get the French Chef song that goes nowhere and is just kind of like a Tom and Jerry skit, and Kiss the Girl. Kiss the Girl is a good song, but during both of these songs, this is a, you know, good 5 to 7 minute stretch where Ariel and Eric are in the same room and should be interacting in some way. But instead, the focus is on the music, and they're sort of staring at each other. It's very boring. And that would have been a great place to establish characterization, let Ariel have more agency, see more of her interacting with the human world and learning about it, and learning about, oh, this isn't a dinglehopper, it's a fork, or whatever. I think it's a misstep to have them have so little dialogue because it makes the relationship not feel as real. And I think that if they'd had, like, one more love song or something, that could have been really fun. Even just take out the French Chef bit and have it be them learning to communicate without words. I don't really care that this takes place in a universe with biology that makes no sense.
Zootopia's biology makes more sense than this film.
You're right. This movie doesn't care.
No, it does not care.
Yeah. And I don't mind when a thing fails something it doesn't try to do.
I want to talk a bit about some heavy-handed metaphors. The last time we talked about metaphors that were this heavy-handed was back in Hunchback with the torn Ace of Hearts. Here, during part of your world, Ariel swims up to the top of her grotto cave, and she reaches through this small opening that she can't quite fit through, and, like, this is the moment of song where she's like, I feel so trapped down in the sea. And part of it is that it's just heavy-handed and blatant, and there's also part of it, it's like, you are literally a princess.
I'm not sure what they do down there. I mean, like, do they...
Down where it's better.
Where it's wetter, yes. Do they have an economy? What do they do for, like, entertainment beyond just singing to each other?
We then have another heavy-handed metaphor during a reprise of that song, just after Ariel saves Eric from drowning and swims off before his butler finds them.
Oh, yeah, the sploosh bit.
Where she's talking about, I don't know how, I don't know when, but I'm gonna...
Gonna walk on land. I'm gonna be a landlubber. And as she does this, she kind of pushes herself up on the rock and water splashes up behind her.
I don't feel bad about sexualizing Ariel in this way because the film loves to do it too.
Apparently Ariel's design was based off of the lead animator's wife, which on the one hand, how romantic. He made his wife's face the model for basically all Disney female main characters from 1989 till now. On the other hand, she's 16.
And also half naked for most of the film.
Yeah.
There's also Ursula gyrating and talking about body language when she's saying you won't miss her voice. There's quite a few bits in Under the Sea that are almost direct nods to Cunnilingus. A lot of Ariel's interactions when she's mute on the surface world play into the naivete of the Born Sexy Yesterday trope.
It's not as bad as some examples. If you don't know it, it's that thing from sci-fi where a person who has no exposure to the modern world, whether that be because they're a clone who was only activated yesterday, or because they're from space, or they're from a remote island, is the romantic subject of the lead, who is usually kind of a schlub, but she doesn't know any better. And her naivete makes her sexy because she's childish. Like, you see this in Fifth Element. I think it's a less bad example than some, because she is 16 years old. She has some knowledge of wanting things, and it's not portrayed as unusual for her to have romantic interests. I appreciate that Eric doesn't seem to fall in love with her for being naive. He thinks she's funny, but not like, oh, you are vulnerable, and that is sexy to me. He's kind of only interested in her when she gets her voice back.
This movie kind of straddles that line between Born Sexy Yesterday and just a typical fish-out-of-water narrative.
So I think this is where we cast our final votes.
Yes.
So I'm still on the side of Little Mermaid, if only because I don't like Zootopia's weird, heavy-handed stuff, and I think it's trying harder and failed harder.
That's fair criticism. I'm still voting for Zootopia, mostly because I think there's much more there to unpack. I think it's much more interesting to talk about, and barring all of the issues with its muddied metaphors, I think the crime thriller narrative is much stronger than anything Little Mermaid has to offer. So, this is the first time we are divided on a vote, where we don't have a guest on.
Mm-hmm. Save us, Daniel. Actually, I mean that literally. Save us, Daniel, and all of our other listeners. We're going to put up a poll on our Facebook, on our Twitter, and we'd love you to vote because we are at an impasse. So we'd appreciate if you voted, and we'll figure out what moves on thanks to your audience participation.
Thankfully, we've got quite a bit of time. We still have two more episodes for round one, and then we have a plethora of more episodes before we get back to this. So there's plenty of time for us to figure it out.
I think both of these films have merits that are worth talking about, and I look forward to seeing what that is. But speaking of looking forward to things, what's up next week?
I would not look forward to what we have next week.
Oh, is it not good?
We have Pinocchio versus Chicken Little.
Can we skip those if I say Zootopia wins?
Unfortunately, no.
Join us next week. Shaggy, Jackson, and a bottle of wine will all be talking about Chicken Little and Pinocchio. Like, share, subscribe, follow us on Twitter and Facebook.
As for the polls, we'll probably put one up on Facebook and one on Twitter, and we will combine the results and we will figure things out. Probably leave that up for about a week.
Yeah.
And then we'll see where that goes. But anyway, thank you for joining us. And this has been the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast, and we hope to have you tune in next week.